Chapter 3. Understanding our material world. The four pillars of modern civilization. Where it matters, ranking is impossible, or at least inadvisable. The heart is not more important than the brain. Vitamin C is no less indispensable for human health than vitamin D. Food and energy supply, the two existential necessities covered in the preceding chapters, would be impossible without mass-scale mobilization of many man-made materials, metals, alloys, non-metallic and synthetic compounds, and the same is true about all our buildings and infrastructures, and about all modes of transportation and communication. Of course, you would not know this if you were to judge the importance of these materials by the attention they get, or rather do not get, not only from mass media news, but also from supposedly much more exalted economic analyses or forecasts of notable developments. All of this coverage deals overwhelmingly with such immaterial, intangible phenomena as the annual percentage growth of GDP, how Western economists used to swoon over China's double-digit rates, rising national debt ratios, unimportant in the world of modern monetary theory, with money supply seen as unlimited, record sums poured into new initial public offerings for such existentially critical inventions as gaming apps, the benefits of unprecedented mobile connectivity, awaiting 5G networks as something close to the second coming, or promises of artificial intelligence imminently transforming our lives. The pandemic was an excellent demonstration of the complete emptiness of such claims. First things first. We could have an accomplished and reasonably affluent civilization that provides plenty of food, material comforts, and access to education and healthcare without any semiconductors, microchips, or personal computers. We had one until, respectively, the mid-1950s. First commercial applications of transistors, the early 1970s, Intel's first microprocessors, and the early 1980s, first larger-scale ownership of PCs. And we managed, until the 1990s, to integrate economies, mobilize necessary investments, build requisite infrastructures, and connect the world by wide-body jetliners without any smartphones, social media, and puerile apps. But none of these advances in electronics and telecommunications could have taken place without the assured provision of energies and materials required to embody the inventions in myriads of electricity-consuming components, devices, assemblies, and systems ranging from tiny microprocessors to massive data centers. Silicon, or SI, made into thin wafers, the basic substrate of microchips, is the signature material of the electronic age. But billions of people could live prosperously without it. It is not an existential constraint on modern civilization. Producing large, high-purity, 99.999999999% pure silicon crystals that are cut into wafers is a complex, multi-step, and highly energy-intensive process. It costs two orders of magnitude more primary energy than making aluminium from bauxite, and three orders of magnitude more than smelting iron and making steel. But the raw material is superabundant. Silicon is the second most common element in the Earth's crust, nearly 28%, compared to 49% for oxygen. And the annual output of electronic-grade silicon is very small compared to other indispensable materials, recently on the order of 10,000 tons of wafers. Of course, annual consumption of a material is not the best indicator of its indispensability. But in this case, the verdict is clear. As useful and as transformative as post-1950 electronic advances have been, they do not constitute the indispensable material foundations of modern civilization. And while there can be no indisputable ordering of our material needs based on claims of their importance, I can offer a defensible ranking that considers their indispensability, ubiquity, and the demand size. Four materials rank highest on this combined scale, and they form what I have called the four pillars of modern civilization: cement, steel, plastics, and ammonia. Physically and chemically, these four materials are distinguished by an enormous diversity of properties and functions. But despite these differences in attributes and specific uses, they share more than their indispensability for the functioning of modern societies. They are needed in larger and still increasing quantities than our other essential inputs. In 2019, the world consumed about 4.5 billion tons of cement, 1.8 billion tons of steel, 370 million tons of plastics, and 150 million tons of ammonia. And they are not readily replaceable by other materials, certainly not in the near future or on a global scale. As noted in Chapter 2, only an impossibly complete recycling of all wastes voided by grazing animals could, together with near-perfect recycling of all other sources of organic nitrogen, provide the amount of nitrogen annually applied to crops in ammonia-based fertilizers. Meanwhile, there are no other materials that can rival the combination of malleability, durability, and light weight offered by many kinds of plastics. Similarly, if we were able to produce identical masses of construction lumber or quarried stone, they could not equal the strength, versatility, and durability of reinforced concrete. We would be able to build pyramids and cathedrals, but not elegant long spans of arched bridges, giant hydroelectric dams, multi-lane roads, or long airport runways. And steel has become so ubiquitous that its irreplaceable deployment determines our ability to extract energies, produce food, and shelter populations, as well as ensuring the extent and quality of all essential infrastructures. No metal could, even remotely, become its substitute. Another key commonality between these four materials is particularly noteworthy as we contemplate the future without fossil carbon. The mass-scale production of all of them depends heavily on the combustion of fossil fuels, and some of these fuels also supply feedstocks for the synthesis of ammonia and for the production of plastics. Iron ore smelting in blast furnaces requires coke made from coal and also natural gas. Energy for cement production comes mostly from coal dust, petroleum coke, and heavy fuel oil. The vast majority of simple molecules that are bonded in long chains or branches to make plastics are derived from crude oils and natural gases. And in the modern synthesis of ammonia, natural gas is both the source of hydrogen and processing energy. As a result, global production of these four indispensable materials claims about 17% of the world's primary energy supply and 25% of all CO2 emissions originating in the combustion of fossil fuels. And currently, there are no commercially available and readily deployable mass-scale alternatives to displace these established processes. Although there is no shortage of proposals and experimental techniques to produce these materials without relying on fossil carbon, ranging from new catalyses for ammonia synthesis to hydrogen-based steelmaking, none of those alternatives has been commercialized. And even if the aggressive pursuit of non-carbon options were to take place, it would obviously take decades to displace the existing capacities that are producing at affordable prices at annual rates of hundreds of millions to billions of tons. In order to truly appreciate the importance of these materials, I will explain their basic properties and functions, outline briefly the histories of technical advances and epoch-making inventions that made them abundantly available and affordable, and describe the enormous variety of their modern uses. I will start with ammonia, because of its indispensability for feeding a growing share of the global population, and proceed in the order of annual global mass production to plastics, steel, and cement. Ammonia, the gas that feeds the world. Of the four substances, and despite my dislike of rankings, it is ammonia that deserves the top position as our most important material. As explained in the previous chapter, without its use as the dominant nitrogen fertilizer, directly or as feedstock for the synthesis of other nitrogenous compounds, it would be impossible to feed at least 40% and up to 50% of today's nearly 8 billion people. Simply restated, in 2020, nearly 4 billion people would not have been alive without synthetic ammonia. No comparable existential constraints apply to plastics or steel, nor to the cement that is required to make concrete, nor, as already noted, to silicon. Ammonia is a simple inorganic compound of one nitrogen and three hydrogens, NH3, which means that nitrogen makes up 82% of its mass. At atmospheric pressure, it is an invisible gas with a characteristic pungent smell of unflushed toilets or decomposing animal manure. Inhaling it in low concentrations causes headaches, nausea, and vomiting. Higher concentrations irritate the eyes, nose, mouth, throat, and lungs, and inhalation of very high concentrations can be instantly fatal. In contrast, ammonium, NH4+, ammonium ion, formed by the dissolution of ammonia in water, is non-toxic and does not easily penetrate cell membranes. Synthesizing this simple molecule was surprisingly challenging. The history of inventions includes famous cases of accidental discoveries. In this chapter on materials, the story of Teflon might be the apposite example. In 1938, Roy Plunkett, a chemist at DuPont, and his assistant, Jack Rebock, formulated tetrafluoroethylene as a new refrigerant compound. After storing it in refrigerated cylinders, they found that the compound underwent unexpected polymerization, turning into polytetrafluoroethylene, a white, waxy, slippery powder. After the Second World War, Teflon became one of the best-known synthetic materials, and perhaps the only one that made it into political jargon. We have Teflon presidents, but seemingly no Bakelite presidents, though there was an Iron Lady. The synthesis of ammonia from its elements belongs to the opposite class of discoveries, those with a clearly defined goal pursued by some of the best qualified scientists and eventually reached by a persevering researcher. The need for this breakthrough was obvious. Between 1850 and 1900, the total population of the industrializing countries of Europe and North America grew from 300 million to 500 million, and rapid urbanization helped to drive a dietary transition from a barely adequate grain-dominated supply to generally higher food energy intakes containing more animal products and sugar. Yields remained stagnant, but the dietary shift was supported by an unprecedented expansion of cropland. Between 1850 and 1900, about 200 million hectares of North and South American, Russian, and Australian grasslands were converted to grain fields. Maturing agronomic science made it clear that the only way to secure adequate food for the larger populations of the 20th century was to raise yields by increasing the supply of nitrogen and phosphorus, two key plant micronutrients. The mining of phosphates, first in North Carolina and then in Florida, and their treatment by acids opened the way to a reliable supply of phosphatic fertilizers. But there was no comparably assured source of nitrogen. The mining of guano, accumulated bird droppings moderately rich in nitrogen, on dry tropical islands had quickly exhausted the richest deposits, and the rising imports of Chilean nitrates, the country's extensive sodium nitrate layers in its arid northern regions, were insufficient to meet future global demand. The challenge was to ensure that humanity could secure enough nitrogen to sustain its expanding numbers. The need was explained in 1898 in the clearest possible manner by William Crookes, chemist and physicist to the British Association for the Advancement of Science, in his presidential address dedicated to the so-called wheat problem. He warned that all civilized nations stand in deadly peril of not having enough to eat. But he saw the way out. Science coming to the rescue, tapping the practically unlimited mass of nitrogen in the atmosphere, present as the unreactive molecule N2, and converting it into compounds assimilable by plants. He rightly concluded that this challenge differs materially from other chemical discoveries which are in the air, so to speak, but are not yet matured. The fixation of nitrogen is vital to the progress of civilized humanity. Other discoveries minister to our increased intellectual comfort, luxury, or convenience. They serve to make life easier, to to hasten the acquisition of wealth or to save time, health, or worry. The fixation of nitrogen is a question of the not far distant future. Crookes' vision was realized just 10 years after his address. The synthesis of ammonia from its elements, nitrogen and hydrogen, was pursued by a number of highly qualified chemists, including Wilhelm Ostwald, a Nobel Prize winner in chemistry in 1909. But in 1908, Fritz Haber, at that time professor of physical chemistry and electrochemistry at the Technische Hochschule in Karlsruhe, working with his English assistant Robert Le Rossignol and supported by BASF, Germany's and the world's leading chemical enterprise, was the first researcher to succeed. His solution relied on using an iron catalyst, a compound that increases the rate of chemical reaction without altering its own composition, and deploying unprecedented reaction pressure. It was a no smaller challenge to scale up Haber's experimental success to a commercial enterprise. Under the leadership of Karl Bosch, an expert in chemical as well as metallurgical engineering, who joined BASF in 1899, success was achieved in just 4 years. The world's first ammonia synthesis plant began to operate at Oppau in September 1913, and the term Haber-Bosch process has endured ever since. Within a year, the Oppau plant's ammonia was diverted to make the nitrate needed to produce explosives for the German army. A new, much larger ammonia factory was completed in 1917 in Luna, but it did little to prevent Germany's defeat. The post-war expansion of ammonia synthesis proceeded despite the economic crisis of the 1930s and continued during the Second World War. But by 1950, synthetic ammonia was still far less common than animal manures. The next 2 decades saw an 8-fold increase of ammonia production to just over 30 million tonnes a year, as synthetic fertiliser enabled the Green Revolution. Starting during the 1960s, the adoption of new superior wheat and rice varieties that, when supplied with adequate nitrogen, produced unprecedented yields. The key innovations behind this rise were the use of natural gas as the source of hydrogen and the introduction of efficient centrifugal compressors and better catalysts. Then, as in so many other instances of modern industrial development, post-Mao China took the lead. Mao was responsible for the deadliest famine in history, 1958 to 1961, and when he died in 1976, the country's per capita food supply was hardly better than when he had proclaimed the existence of the communist state in 1949. China's first major business deal to follow President Nixon's trip to Beijing in 1972 was an order for 13 of the world's most advanced ammonia urea plants from M.W. Kellogg of Texas. By 1984, the country abolished urban food rationing, and by the year 2000, its average daily per capita food supply was higher than Japan's. The only way to make this happen was by breaking the country's nitrogen barrier and raising the annual grain harvest to more than 650 million tonnes a year. The best account of recent nitrogen flows in China's agriculture shows that about 60% of the nutrient available to the country's crops comes from synthetic ammonia. Feeding 3 out of 5 of the Chinese population thus depends on the synthesis of this compound. The corresponding global mean is about 50%. This dependence easily justifies calling the Haber-Bosch synthesis of ammonia perhaps the most momentous technical advance in history. Other inventions, as William Crookes correctly judged, minister to our comforts, convenience, luxury, wealth, or productivity, and others yet save our lives from premature death and chronic disease. But without the synthesis of ammonia, we could not ensure the very survival of large shares of today's and tomorrow's population. I hasten to add that the 50% of humanity dependent on ammonia is not an immutable approximation. Given prevailing diets and farming practices, synthetic nitrogen feeds half of humanity. Or, everything else being equal, half of the world's population could not be sustained without synthetic nitrogenous fertilizers. But the share would be lower if the affluent world converted to the largely meatless Indian diet, and it would be higher if the entire world ate as well as the Chinese do today, to say nothing about the universal adoption of the American diet. We could also reduce our dependence on nitrogenous fertilizers by cutting our food waste, as we heard earlier, and by using the fertilizers more efficiently. About 80% of global ammonia production is used to fertilize crops. The rest is used to make nitric acid, explosives, rocket propellants, dyes, fibers, and window and floor cleaners. With proper precautions and special equipment, ammonia can be applied directly to fields. But the compound is mostly used as the indispensable feedstock for producing solid and liquid nitrogenous fertilizers. Urea, the solid fertilizer with the highest nitrogen content, 46%, dominates. Recently, it has accounted for about 55% of all nitrogen applied to the world's fields, and it is widely used in Asia to support the rice and wheat harvests of China and India, the world's two most populous nations, and to guarantee good yields in five other Asian countries with more than 100 million inhabitants. Less important nitrogenous fertilizers include ammonium nitrate, ammonium sulfate, and calcium ammonium nitrate, as well as various liquid solutions. Once the nitrogen fertilizers are applied to fields, it is almost impossible to control their natural losses due to volatilization from ammonia compounds, leaching, nitrates are readily soluble in water, and denitrification, the bacteria-driven conversion of nitrates back to nitrogen molecules in the air. There are now only two effective direct solutions to field losses of nitrogen: the spreading of expensive slow-release compounds and, more practically, turning to precision farming and applying fertilizers only as needed based on analyses of the soil. As already noted, indirect measures, including higher food prices and reduced meat consumption, could be effective but are not highly popular. As a result, it is unlikely that any realistically conceivable combination of these solutions can bring about a radical change to the global consumption of nitrogenous fertilizers. About 150 megatons of ammonia are now synthesized annually, with about 80% used as fertilizer. Nearly 60% of that fertilizer is applied in Asia, about a quarter in Europe and North America, and less than 5% in Africa. Most rich countries certainly could and should pull back on their high application rates. Their average per capita food supply is already too high, and China and India, two heavy users, have many opportunities to reduce their excessive fertilizer applications. But Africa, the continent with the fastest growing population, remains deprived of the nutrient and is a substantial food importer. Any hope for its greater food self-sufficiency rests on the increased use of nitrogen. After all, the continent's recent usage of ammonia has been less than a third of the European mean. The best and long-sought solution to boost nitrogen supply would be to endow non-leguminous plants with nitrogen-fixing capabilities, a promise genetic engineering is yet to deliver on, while a less radical option, inoculating seeds with a nitrogen-fixing bacterium, is a recent innovation whose eventual commercial extent is still unclear. Plastics. Diverse, useful, troublesome. Plastics are a large group of synthetic or semi-synthetic organic materials whose common quality is that they are fit for forming or molding. Synthesis of plastics begins with monomers, simple molecules that can be bonded in long chains or branches to make polymers. The two key monomers, ethylene and propylene, are produced by the steam cracking, heating to 750 to 950 degrees Celsius, of hydrocarbon feedstocks, and hydrocarbons also energize subsequent syntheses. The malleability of plastics makes it possible to form them by casting, pressing, or extruding, and they create shapes ranging from thin film to heavy-duty pipes, and from feather-like bottles to massive and sturdy waste containers. Global output has been dominated by thermoplastics, polymers that soften readily when heated and harden again when cooled. Low and high-density polyethylene, or PE now accounts for more than 20% of the world's plastic polymers, polypropylene, PP, for about 15%, and polyvinyl chloride, or PVC, for more than 10%. In contrast, thermoset plastics, including polyurethanes, polyamides, melamine, and urea formaldehyde, resist softening when heated. Some thermoplastics combine low specific gravity, light weight, with fairly high hardness, durability. Durable aluminium weighs only a third as much as carbon steel, but PVC density is less than 20% and PP less than 12% compared to steel. And while the ultimate tensile strength of structural steel is 400 megapascals, that of polystyrene is at 100 megapascals, twice that of wood or glass, and only 10% less than that of aluminium. This combination of low weight and high strength has made thermoplastics the preferred choice for such applications as heavy-duty pipes and flanges, anti-skid surfaces, and chemical tanks. Thermoplastic polymers have found widespread uses in car interiors and exteriors, PP bumpers, PVC dashboards and car parts, polycarbonate headlight lenses. Light, high-temperature or flame-retardant thermoplastics, polycarbonate, PVC acrylic blends, dominate the interiors of modern aircraft. And carbon fibre-reinforced plastics, composite materials, are now used for building aircraft airframes. The first plastics, most notably celluloid, made from cellulose nitrate and camphor, later the highly flammable mainstay of the film industry, displaced only during the 1950s, were produced in small amounts during the last three decades of the 19th century. But the first thermoset material, moulded at 150 to 160 degrees Celsius, was prepared in 1907 by Leo Hendrik Bakerland, a Belgian chemist working in New York. His General Bakelite Company, founded in 1910, was the first industrial producer of a plastic that was moulded into pieces ranging from electric insulators to black rotary dial telephones, and during the Second World War, used for parts in lightweight weapons. Meanwhile, cellophane was invented in 1908 by Jacques Brandenburger. During the interwar years came the first large-scale syntheses of PVC, which was discovered as early as 1838 but never used outside a laboratory. And DuPont in the US, Imperial Chemical Industries, or ICI, in the UK, and IG Farben in Germany funded, very successfully, research dedicated to the discovery of new plastic materials. Before the Second World War, this resulted in the commercial production of cellulose acetate, now in absorbent cloths and wipes, neoprene, synthetic rubber, polyester, for fabrics and upholstery, polymethyl methacrylate, otherwise known as plexiglass, and now even more commonly used thanks to the COVID-induced resurgence of dividers and shields. Nylon has been produced since 1938. Toothbrush bristles and stockings were the first commercial products. It now goes into products ranging from fishing nets to parachutes. And, as already noted, so has Teflon, a ubiquitous non-stick coating. The affordable production of styrene also began during the 1930s, and the material is now mostly used as polystyrene, or PS, in packing materials and disposable cups and plates. IG Farben introduced polyurethanes in 1937, furniture foams insulation. ICI used very high pressure to synthesized polyethylene used in packaging and insulation and began producing methyl methacrylate for adhesives, coatings and paints in 1933. Polyethylene terephthalate, or PET, since the 1970s the scourge of the planet in the form of discarded drink bottles, was patented in 1941. And mass-produced since the early 1950s. The infernal PET bottle was patented in 1973. The best-known post-Second World War additions include polycarbonates for optical lenses, windows, rigid covers, polyamide for medical tubing, liquid crystal polymers, above all for electronics, and such famous DuPont trademarks as Tyvek in 1955, Lycra 1959, and Kevlar 1971. By the end of the 20th century, 50 different kinds of plastics were on the global market, And this new diversity, together with rising demand for the most commonly used compounds, PE, PP, PVC and PET, led to exponential growth in demand. Global production rose from only about 20,000 tonnes in 1925 to 2 million tonnes by 1950, 150 million tonnes by the year 2000, and about 370 million tonnes by 2019. The best way to appreciate the ubiquity of plastic materials in our daily lives is to note how many times a day our hands touch, our eyes see, our bodies rest on, and our feet tread on a plastic. You might be astonished at the frequency of such encounters. As I am typing this, the keys of my Dell laptop and a wireless mouse under my right palm are made of acrylonitrile butadiene styrene. I sit on a swivel chair, upholstered in a polyester fabric, and its nylon wheels rest on a polycarbonate carpet protection mat that covers a polyester carpet. An industry that started by supplying small industrial parts, a gear lever knob in the 1916 Rolls-Royce was the first application, and various household items has vastly expanded those two original commercial niches, most prominently with consumer electronics adding billions of new plastic-dependent items every year, and has added mass-scale applications ranging from car bodies and complete interiors of airplanes to large-diameter pipes. But plastics have found their most indispensable roles in healthcare in general, and in the hospital treatment of infectious diseases in particular. Modern life now begins in maternity wards and ends in intensive care units, surrounded by plastic items. And those people who had no prior understanding of plastic's role in modern healthcare got their lesson thanks to COVID-19. The pandemic has taught us this in often drastic ways, as doctors and nurses in North America and Europe ran out of personal protective equipment, or PPE, disposable gloves, masks, shields, hats, gowns and booties, and as governments outbid each other in order to airlift limited and highly overpriced supplies from China, to which the Western producers of PPE, obsessed with cutting costs, had relocated most of their production lines, creating dangerous yet entirely avoidable supply shortages. Plastic items in hospitals are made above all from different kinds of PVC. Flexible tubes, used for feeding patients, delivering oxygen and monitoring blood pressure. Catheters. Intravenous containers, blood bags, sterile packaging, assorted trays and basins, bedpans and bed rails, thermal blankets, and countless pieces of labware. PVC is now the primary component in more than a quarter of all healthcare products, and in modern homes it is present in wall and roof membranes, window frames, blinds, hoses, cable insulation, electronic components, a still growing array of office supplies and toys, and as credit cards used to purchase all of these. Recent years have seen rising concerns about plastic pollution on land and even more so in the ocean, coastal waters and on beaches. I will return to this in the environmental chapter, but this irresponsible dumping of plastics is not an argument against the proper use of these diverse and often truly indispensable synthetic materials. Moreover, as far as microfibers go, it is wrong to assume, as so many do, that most of their presence in ocean water derives from the wear and tear of synthetic textiles. These polymers now account for two-thirds of global fibre output, but a study of seawater samples showed that oceanic fibres are mainly greater than 90% of natural origin. Steel, ubiquitous and recyclable. Steels, the plural is more accurate as there are more than 3,500 varieties, are alloys dominated by iron, or Fe. Pig, or cast iron, the hot metal produced by blast furnaces, is typically 95 to 97% iron, 1.8 to 4% carbon, and 0.5 to 3% silicon, with mere traces of a few other elements. Its high carbon content makes it brittle. It has low ductility, the ability to stretch, and its tensile strength, resistance to breaking under tension, is inferior to that of bronze or brass. Pre-industrial steel was made in Asia and in Europe by a variety of artisanal methods. That is, always laboriously and expensively, and hence it was never available for common use. Modern steels are made from cast iron by reducing its high carbon content to 0.08 to 2.1% by weight. Steel's physical properties handily beat those of the hardest stones, as well as those of the other two most common metals. Granite has a similar compressive strength, capacity to withstand loads that shorten the material, but its tensile strength is an order of magnitude lower. Granite columns bear their load as well as steel, but steel beams can bear loads 15 to 30 times higher. Steel's typical tensile strength is about 7 times that of aluminium and nearly 4 times that of copper. Its hardness is, respectively, 4 and 8 times higher. And it is heat resistant. Aluminium melts at 660 degrees Celsius, copper at 1085 degrees Celsius, steel only at 1425 degrees Celsius. Steels come in 4 major categories. Carbon steels, 90% of all steels on the market are 0.3 to 0.95% carbon, are everywhere, from bridges to fridges and from gears to shears. Alloy steels include varying shares of one or more elements, most commonly manganese, nickel, silicon, and chromium, but also aluminium, molybdenum, titanium, and vanadium, added in order to improve their physical properties, hardness, strength, ductility. Stainless steel, 10 to 20% chromium, was made for the first time only in 1912 for kitchenware, and is now widely used for surgical instruments, engines, machine parts, and in construction. Tool steels have a tensile strength 2 to 4 times higher than the best construction steels, and they are used for cutting steel and other metals for dies, for stamping or extrusion of other metals or plastics, as well as for manual cutting and hammering. And all steels, except for some stainless varieties, are magnetic and hence suitable for making electric machinery. Steel determines the look of modern civilization and enables its most fundamental functions. This is the most widely used metal, and it forms countless visible and invisible critical components of today's world. Moreover, nearly all other metallic and non-metallic products we use have been extracted, processed, shaped, finished, and distributed with tools and machines made of steel. And no mode of today's mass transportation could function without steel. Naked steel is ubiquitous inside and outside of our homes. In items small, cutlery, knives, cooking pots, pans, kitchen gadgets, garden tools, and large, appliances, lawnmowers, bicycles, cars. Before large city buildings go up, you can see massive steel pile-driving machines ramming in steel or steel-reinforced concrete for the foundations. And then the site is dominated for months by tall steel construction cranes. In 1954, New York's Saucony Mobile Building was the first skyscraper entirely clad in stainless steel. And more recently, Dubai's 828-metre-tall Burj Khalifa uses textured stainless steel spandrel panels and vertical tubular steel pins. Steel is both the critical structural component and the design feature of many elegant cantilevered and suspension bridges. In San Francisco's Golden Gate Bridge, it is constantly repainted orange. Japan's Akashi Kaiokyo Bridge has the world's longest central span at nearly 2 kilometres, and its steel towers support woven steel cables that are 1.12 metres in diameter. City streets are lined by regularly spaced lighting poles made from hot-dip galvanised and powder-coated steel for rust resistance. Rolled steel makes roadside traffic signs and structures for overhead signage, and corrugated steel is used for crash barriers. Steel towers support thick steel wires to lift downhill skiers by the millions and to carry visitors in cable cars to tall peaks. Radio and TV towers, guide masts, broke many height records for man-made structures, and modern landscapes contain seemingly endless repetitions of high-voltage electricity transmission towers. Two recent prominent additions are dizzyingly tall guide towers to carry mobile telephone signals and groups of large wind turbine towers, both onshore and offshore, and the most massive steel assemblies in the ocean are huge oil and gas production platforms. By weight, steel is nearly always the largest part of transportation equipment. Jetliners are a major exception. Aluminium alloys and composite fibers dominate, and steel is about 10% of the plane's weight, in engines and the landing gear. The average car contains about 900 kilograms of steel. With nearly 100 million motor vehicles produced per year, this translates to about 90 billion tons of the metal, about 60% of it being high-strength steel that makes vehicles 26 to 40% lighter than conventional steel. Although modern high-speed trains, aluminium bodies and plastic interiors are only about 15% steel, wheels, axles, bearings and motors, their operation requires dedicated tracks using heavier-than-normal steel rails. Ship hulls of oil and liquefied gas tankers and of bulk carriers transporting ores, grains or cement are made by bending large plates of high tensile steel into desired shapes and welding them together. But the greatest revolution in post-war shipping has been the deployment of container ships. For more detail, listen to Chapter 4. They transport cargo in steel crates of standardized dimensions. These steel boxes are about 2.5 meters high and wide, length varies, and are stacked inside the hulls and high above the deck. Chances are that everything you wear was carried to its final point of sale in a steel container that started its journey in a factory in Asia. And how were all these tools and machines made? Mostly by other machines and assemblies made largely of steel and which do casting, forging, rolling, subtractive machining, turning, milling, hollowing and drilling, bending, welding, sharpening and cutting, the latter operations being possible thanks to amazing tool steels that cut carbon steels as easily as a knife goes through soft butter. And the machines that make machines are mostly powered by electricity, whose generation, and hence also the entire universe of electronics, computing and telecommunication, is impossible without steel. Tall boilers crammed with steel tubes and filled with pressurized water. Nuclear reactors enclosed in thick pressure vessels. Expanding steam rotating large turbines whose long shafts are machined from rough, massive steel forgings. Steel that is out of sight underground includes fixed and moving props in deep mines. And millions of kilometers of exploratory, casing and production pipes in crude oil and natural gas wells. The oil and gas industry also depends on steel buried close to the surface, 1 to 2 meters deep, in gathering, transmission and distribution pipelines. Trunk lines use pipes with diameters of more than 1 meter, while distribution gas lines may be just 5 centimeters across. Crude oil refineries are essentially forests of steel, with tall distillation columns, catalytic crackers, extensive piping and storage vessels. Finally, I must note how steel saves lives in hospitals. From centrifuges and diagnostic machines to stainless steel scalpels, surgical hooks and retractors. And how it also kills. Armies and fleets with their vast arrays of weapons are nothing but enormous repositories of steel dedicated to destruction. Can we secure the required massive supply of steel, and how consequential is the metal's global production? Do we have adequate supplies of iron ore to keep making steel for many generations to come? Can we produce enough of it in order to build modern infrastructures and raise the standards of living in low-income countries, where average per capita steel consumption is even lower than it was in the affluent economies a century ago? Is steelmaking environmentally friendly, or is it exceptionally damaging? Can we produce the metal without using any fossil fuels? The answer to the second question is unequivocally positive. Iron is the Earth's dominant element by mass because it is heavy, nearly 8 times as heavy as water, and because it forms the planet's core. But it is also abundant in the Earth's crust. Only 3 elements, oxygen, silicon, and aluminium, are more common. Iron, with nearly 6%, ranks 4th. annual production of iron ore, led by Australia, Brazil and China, is now about 2.5 billion tonnes. World resources are in excess of 800 billion tonnes, containing nearly 250 billion tonnes of the metal. This is a resource-slash-production RP ratio of more than 300 years, far beyond any conceivable planning horizons. The RP ratio for crude oil is just 50 years. Moreover, steel is readily recycled by melting it in an electric arc furnace, or EAF, a massive cylindrical heat-resistant container made of heavy steel plates, lined with magnesium bricks with a removable dome-like water-cooled lid through which three massive carbon electrodes are inserted. After loading the steel scrap, the electrodes are lowered into it. An electric current passing through them forms an arc whose temperature, 1,800 degrees Celsius, easily melts the charged metal. However, their electricity demand is enormous. Even a highly efficient modern EAF needs as much electricity every day as an American city of about 150,000 people. Vehicle recycling is preceded by draining all fluids, ripping out upholstery, and removing batteries, servo motors, tyres, radios and working engines, as well as plastic, rubber, glass and aluminium components. Car crushers then flatten the stripped bodies preparatory to shredding. By far the most challenging recycling operation is the dismantling of large ocean-going vessels, done mostly on beaches in Pakistan. Gadani, northwest of Karachi, India, Alang in Gujarat, and Bangladesh, near Chittagong. Stripped hulls made of heavy steel plates must be cut by gas and plasma torches, dangerous and polluting work done too often by men working without proper protective gear. Affluent economies now recycle nearly all of their automotive scrap, have a similarly high rate, greater than 90%, for reusing structural steel beams and plates, and only a slightly lower rate for recycling household appliances. And the US has recently recycled more than 65% of reinforcement bars in concrete, a rate similar to the recycling of beverage and food steel cans. Steel scrap has become one of the world's most valuable export commodities, as countries with a long history of steel production and with plenty of accumulated scrap sell the material to expanding producers. The EU is the largest exporter, followed by Japan, Russia and Canada, and China, India and Turkey are the top buyers. Recycled steel accounts for almost 30% of the metal's total annual output, with national shares ranging from 100% for several small steel producers to almost 70% in the US, about 40% in the EU and to less than 12% in China. This means that primary steelmaking still dominates, producing more than twice as much hot metal every year as is recycled, almost 1.3 billion tonnes in 2019. The process starts with blast furnaces, tall iron and steel structures lined with heat-resistant materials that produce liquid, cast or pig iron by smelting iron ore, coke and limestone. The second step, reducing cast iron's high carbon content and producing steel, takes place in a BOF, basic oxygen furnace. The adjective refers to the chemical properties of the produced slag. The process was invented during the 1940s and was rapidly commercialized after the mid-1950s. Today's BOFs are large, pear-shaped vessels with an open top used to charge up to 300 tons of hot iron, which gets blasted with oxygen blown in from both top and bottom. The reaction reduces the metal's carbon content to as little as 0.04% in about 30 minutes. The combination of a blast furnace and a basic oxygen furnace is the basis of modern integrated steelmaking. Final steps include the transfer of hot steel to continuous casting machines to produce steel slabs, billets, square or rectangular shapes, and strips that are eventually converted into final steel products. Iron making is highly energy intensive, with about 75% of the total demand claimed by blast furnaces. Today's best practices have a combined demand of just 17 to 20 gigajoules per tonne of finished product, Less efficient operations require 25 to 30 gigajoules per tonne. Obviously, the energy cost of secondary steel made in EAFs is much lower than the cost of integrated production. Today's best performance is just above 2 gigajoules per tonne. To this must be added the energy costs of rolling the metal, mostly 1.5 to 2 gigajoules per tonne, and hence the representative global rates for the overall energy cost may be about 25 gigajoules per tonne for integrated steelmaking and 5 gigajoules per tonne for recycled steel. The total energy requirement of global steel production in 2019 was about 34 exajoules, or about 6% of the world's primary energy supply. Given the industry's dependence on coking coal and natural gas, steelmaking has been also a major contributor to the anthropogenic generation of greenhouse gases. The World Steel Association puts the average global rate at 500 kilograms of carbon per ton, with recent primary steelmaking emitting about 900 megatons of carbon a year, or 7 to 9% of direct emissions from the global combustion of fossil fuels. But steel is not the only major material responsible for a significant share of CO2 emissions. Cement is much less energy intensive, but because its global output is nearly 3 times that of steel, its production is responsible for a very similar share, about 8% of emitted carbon. Concrete, a world created by cement. Cement is the indispensable component of concrete, and it is produced by heating to at least 1450 degrees Celsius ground limestone, a source of calcium, and clay, shale, or waste materials. Sources of silicon, aluminium, and iron in large kilns, long 100 to 220 metres, inclined metal cylinders. This high-temperature sintering produces clinker, fused limestone and aluminosilicates that is ground to yield fine, powdery cement. Concrete consists largely, 65 to 85%, of aggregates and also water, 15 to 20%. Finer aggregates, such as sand, result in stronger concrete, but need more water in the mix than do coarser aggregates that use different sizes of gravel. The mixture is held together by cement, typically 10 to 15% of concrete's final mass, whose reaction with water first sets the mixture and then hardens it. The result is now the most massively deployed material of modern civilization. Hard and heavy and able to withstand decades of punishing use, particularly when it is reinforced with steel. Plain concrete is fairly good in compression, and the best modern varieties are 5 times stronger than those of 2 generations ago, but weak in tension. Structural steel has tension strength up to 100 times higher, and different types of reinforcing, steel mesh, steel bars, glass or steel fibres, PP, have been used to narrow this huge gap. Since 2007, most of humanity has lived in cities made possible by concrete. Of course, there are plenty of other materials in urban buildings. Skyscrapers have steel skeletons covered by glass or metal. Detached houses in North American suburbs are made of wood, studs, plywood, particle board, and gypsum drywall, and are often sheathed in brick or stone. And engineered lumber is now used to build apartments many stories high. But skyscrapers and tall apartment buildings stand on concrete piles. Concrete goes not only into foundations and basements, but also into many walls and ceilings, and it is ubiquitous in all urban infrastructures, from buried engineering networks, large pipes, cable channels, sewers, subway foundations, tunnels, to above-ground transportation infrastructure. Sidewalks, roads, bridges, shipping piers, airport runways. Modern cities, from Sao Paulo and Hong Kong, with their multi-storied apartment towers, to Los Angeles and Beijing, with their extensive networks of freeways, are embodiments of concrete. Roman cement was a mixture of gypsum, quicklime, and volcanic sand, and it proved to be an excellent and durable material for large structures, including expansive vaults. The Pantheon. Intact after nearly 2 millennia, it was completed in 126 CE still spans a greater distance than any other structure made of non-reinforced concrete. But the preparation of modern cement was patented only in 1824 by Joseph Aspdin, an English bricklayer. His hydraulic mortar was made by firing limestone and clay at high temperatures. Lime, silica, and alumina present in these materials are vitrified or transformed into a glass-like substance, whose grinding produced Portland cement. Aspdin chose that name, still widely used today, because once hardened and after reacting with water, the glassy clinker had a colour similar to limestone from the Isle of Portland in the English Channel. As already noted, the new material was excellent in compression, and today's best concretes can withstand pressure of more than 100 megapascals, which is about the weight of an African bull elephant balanced on a coin. Tension is a different matter. A pulling force of just 2 to 5 megapascals, less than it takes to tear human skin, can break concrete apart. That is why the large-scale commercial adoption of concrete in construction took place only after gradual advances in steel reinforcement made it suitable for structural parts subject to high tension. During the 1860s and 1870s, the first reinforcing patents were filed by François Coignet and Joseph Monnier in France. Monnier, a gardener, began to use iron mesh to reinforce his planters. But the real breakthrough came in 1884, with Ernest Ransome's reinforcing steel bars. The earliest designs of modern cement rotary kilns, where the minerals are vitrified at temperatures of up to 1,500 degrees Celsius, appeared during the 1890s and made it possible to use affordable concrete in large projects. The 16-story Ingalls Building in Cincinnati became the world's first reinforced concrete skyscraper in 1903. Just 3 years later, Thomas Edison became convinced that concrete should replace wood in the building of American detached houses and began to design and cast in place concrete homes in New Jersey. In 1911, he tried to revive the failed project by also offering cheap concrete furniture, including entire bedroom sets, and even made a phonograph, one of his favourite inventions, out of concrete. At the same time, in contrast to Edison's failure, Robert Mayer, a Swiss engineer, pioneered a concrete construction trend that is still going strong. Reinforced concrete bridges, starting with the relatively short Zuotz in 1901 and Tavanasse in 1906. His most famous design, the bold Zalgina Tobel arch above an alpine ravine, was completed in 1930 and is now an International Historic Civil Engineering landmark. Early concrete designs were also favoured by architects Auguste Perret in France, elegant apartments and the Théâtre des Champs-Élysées, and Frank Lloyd Wright in the US. Wright's most famous interwar concrete designs were Tokyo's Imperial Hotel, finished just before the 1923 earthquake levelled the city and damaged the new structure, and Falling Water in Pennsylvania, completed in 1939. The Guggenheim Museum in New York was his last famous concrete design, completed in 1959. The tensile strength of reinforcing steel was further improved by pouring concrete into forms whose wires or bars were tensioned just before pouring the concrete. Pre-stressing, with end anchors that are used to tension the steel and are released once the concrete bonds with the metal, or after it, post-stressing, with steel tendons locked in place inside protective sleeves. The first major pre-stress design, Eugène Freycinet's Plougastel Bridge near Brest, was finished in 1930. With its bold, white, sail-like design, Jørn Utzon's Sydney Opera House, built between 1959 and 1973, is perhaps the world's most famous pre-stressed concrete structure. Pre-stressing is now common, and the longest reinforced concrete bridges are not crossing rivers or ravines, but rather railroad viaducts for high-speed trains. The record goes to the 164.8-kilometre Danyang-Kunshan Grand Bridge in China, completed in 2010, part of the Beijing-Shanghai High-Speed Railway. Reinforced concrete is now inside every large modern building and every transportation infrastructure, from port piers to segmental rings installed by modern tunnel boring machines under the Channel and the Alps. The standard configuration of the US interstate highway system is a layer of about 28 centimeters of non-reinforced concrete on top of a twice as thick layer of natural aggregates, stones, gravel, sand, and the entire interstate system contains about 50 million tons of cement, 1.5 billion metric tons of aggregates, and only about 6 million tons of steel for structural support and culvert pipes. Airport runways, up to 3.5 kilometers long, have reinforced concrete foundations. Deepest, up to 1.5 meters, in the touchdown zone to handle the repeated pounding of hundreds of thousands of landings every year by airplanes weighing up to about 380 tons, like the Airbus 380. For example, Canada's longest runway, 4.27 kilometers in Calgary, required more than 85,000 cubic meters of concrete and 16,000 tons of reinforcing steel. But by far the most massive structures built of reinforced concrete are the world's largest dams. The era of these megastructures began during the 1930s with the construction of the Hoover Dam on the Colorado River and the Grand Coulee Dam on the Columbia River. The vertiginous Hoover Dam, located in a gorge southeast of Las Vegas, required about 3.4 million cubic meters of concrete and 20,000 tons of reinforcing steel, twice as much plate and pipe steel, and 8,000 tons of structural steel. Hundreds of these massive structures were built during the second half of the 20th century, and the world's largest dam, China's Sanxia, Three Gorges on the Yangtze, generating electricity since 2011, has its almost 28 million cubic meters of concrete reinforced with 256,500 tons of steel. Annual American cement consumption rose tenfold between 1900 and 1928 when it reached 30 million tons. And the post-war construction boom, including the construction of the interstate highway system, and the expansion of the country's airports tripled by the century's end. The peak was reached at about 128 million tonnes in 2005, and recent rates are around 100 million tonnes a year. This is now a tiny fraction of the annual demand in the world's number one cement consumer, China. In 1980, at the outset of its modernisation drive, it produced less than 80 million tonnes of cement. In 1985, it surpassed the US to become the world's largest producer. And in 2019, its output of about 2.2 billion tonnes was just over half of the global total. Perhaps the most stunning outcome of this rise is that in just 2 years, 2018 and 2019, China produced nearly as much cement, about 4.4 billion tonnes, as did the United States during the entire 20th century, 4.56 billion tonnes. Not surprisingly, the country now has the world's most extensive systems of freeways, rapid trains and airports, as well as the largest number of giant hydro stations and new multi-million population cities. Yet another astounding statistic is that the world now consumes in 1 year more cement than it did during the entire first half of the 20th century. And, both fortunately and unfortunately, these enormous masses of modern concrete will not last as long as the Pantheon's coffered dome. Ordinary construction concrete is not a highly durable material, and it is subject to many environmental assaults. Exposed surfaces are attacked by moisture, freezing, bacterial and algal growth, especially in the tropics, acid deposition, and vibration. Buried concrete structures suffer from crack-inducing pressures and from damage caused by reactive compounds seeping from above. Concrete's high alkalinity, freshly poured material has a pH of about 12.5, is an effective guard against the corrosion of the reinforcing steel, but cracks and exfoliation expose the metal to corrosive disintegration. Chlorides attack concrete submerged in seawater and concrete on winter roads where salt is used for de-icing. Between 1990 and 2020, the mass-scale concretization of the modern world has emplaced nearly 700 billion tons of hard but slowly crumbling material. The durability of concrete structures varies widely. While it is impossible to offer an average longevity figure, many will deteriorate badly after just two or three decades, while others will do well for 60 to 100 years. This means that during the 21st century, we will face unprecedented burdens of concrete deterioration, renewal and removal, with obviously a particularly acute problem in China, as structures will have to be torn down in order to be replaced or destroyed or abandoned. Concrete structures can be slowly demolished, reinforcing steel can be separated, and both materials can be recycled. Not cheap, but perfectly possible. After crushing and sieving, the aggregate can be incorporated in new concrete, and reinforcing steel can be recycled. Even now, replacement concrete and new concrete are needed everywhere. In affluent countries with low population growth, the main need is to fix decaying infrastructures. The latest report card for the US awards nothing but poor to very poor grades to all sectors where concrete dominates, with dams, roads and aviation getting Ds and the overall average grade just D+. This appraisal gives an inkling of what China might face, mass and money-wise, by 2050. In contrast, the poorest countries need essential infrastructures, and the most basic need in many homes in Africa and Asia is to replace mud floors with concrete floors in order to improve overall hygiene and to reduce the incidence of parasitic diseases by nearly 80%. With aging populations, migrations to cities, economic globalization, and widespread regional declines, more concrete will simply be abandoned worldwide. Concrete ruins of car factories in Detroit, abandoned enterprises in Europe's old industrial regions, and all those now derelict plants and monuments built by Soviet central planners on the Russian plain and in Siberia are only the first waves of this trend. Other common and prominent concrete relics are thick-walled defensive bunkers, such as those of Normandy and the Maginot Line, and massive concrete silos that formerly housed nuclear missiles and now sit empty on America's Great Plains. Material outlook. Old and new inputs. During the first half of the 21st century, with slower global population growth and with stagnant or even declining counts in many affluent countries, economies should have no problems meeting the demand for steel, cement, ammonia and plastics, especially with intensified recycling. But it is unlikely that by 2050, all of these industries will eliminate their dependence on fossil fuels and cease to be significant contributors to global CO2 emissions. This is especially unlikely in today's low-income modernizing countries, whose enormous infrastructural and consumer needs will require large-scale increases of all basic materials. Replicating the post-1990 Chinese experience in those countries would amount to a 15-fold increase of steel output, a more than 10-fold boost for cement production, a more than doubling of ammonia synthesis, and a more than 30-fold increase of plastic syntheses. Obviously, even if other modernizing countries accomplish only half or even just a quarter of China's recent material advances, these countries would still see multiplications of their current uses. Requirements for fossil carbon have been, and for decades will continue to be, the price we pay for the multitude of benefits arising from our reliance on steel, cement, ammonia, and plastics. And as we continue to expand renewable energy conversions, we will require larger masses of old materials as well as unprecedented quantities of materials that were previously needed in only modest amounts. Two prominent examples illustrate this unfolding material dependence. No structures are more obvious symbols of green electricity generation than large wind turbines. But these enormous accumulations of steel, cement, and plastics are also embodiments of fossil fuels. Their foundations are reinforced concrete. Their towers, nacelles, and rotors are steel, altogether nearly 200 tons of it for every megawatt of installed generating capacity. And their massive blades are energy intensive and difficult to recycle, plastic resins, about 15 tons of them for a mid-sized turbine. All of these giant parts must be brought to the installation sites by outsized trucks and erected by large steel cranes, and turbine gearboxes must be repeatedly lubricated with oil. Multiplying these requirements by the millions of turbines that would be needed to eliminate electricity generated from fossil fuels shows how misleading any talks are about the coming dematerialization of green economies. Electric cars provide perhaps the best example of new and enormous material dependencies. A typical lithium car battery, weighing about 450 kilograms, contains about 11 kilograms of lithium, nearly 14 kilograms of cobalt, 27 kilograms of nickel, more than 40 kilograms of copper, and 50 kilograms of graphite, as well as about 181 kilograms of steel, aluminium, and plastics. Supplying these materials for a single vehicle requires processing about 40 tons of ores, and given the low concentration of many elements in their ores, it necessitates extracting and processing about 225 tons of raw materials. Again, we would have to multiply this by close to 100 million units, which is the annual worldwide production of internal combustion vehicles that would have to be replaced by electric drive. Uncertainties about the future rates of electric vehicle adoption are large, but a detailed assessment of material needs, based on two scenarios, assuming that 25% or 50% of the global fleet in 2050 would be electric vehicles, found the following. From 2020 to 2050, demand for lithium would grow by factors of 18 to 20, for cobalt by 17 to 19, for nickel by 28 to 31, and factors of 15 to 20 would apply for most other materials from 2020. Obviously, this would require not only a drastic expansion of lithium, cobalt, a large share of it now coming from Congo's perilously hand-dug deep shafts and from widespread child labour, and nickel extraction and processing, but also an extensive search for new resources. And these, in turn, could not take place without large additional conversions of fossil fuels and electricity. Generating smoothly rising forecasts of future electric vehicle ownership is one thing. Creating these new material supplies on a mass global scale is quite another. Modern economies will always be tied to massive material flows, whether those of ammonia-based fertilizers to feed the still-growing global population, plastics, steel, and cement needed for new tools, machines, structures, and infrastructures, or new inputs required to produce solar cells, wind turbines, electric cars, and storage batteries. And until all energies used to extract and process these materials come from renewable conversions, modern civilization will remain fundamentally dependent on the fossil fuels used in the production of these indispensable materials. No AI, no apps, and no electronic messages will change that.